Okay, so I will continue the subject. Can you hear me? And focus on JRB accretion disks and jets. First of all, I should mention what the progenitors of the JRBs are. There's two likely models that we discussed most. There's a binary neutron star, you have merger of two neutron stars, and you have a collapsing massive star. And in both cases, we think you get a black hole and accretion disk around the black hole. So you get the same setup of the problem as you have in X-ray binaries, for example, or quasars. So you have accretion onto a black hole. The major difference from other situations where this problem was studied for years is that the accretion rate is much, much higher. But otherwise, it's the same problem to the first approximation. Well, this is our dream about this general disk outflow engine. And we think that magnetic fields play a role here. And I'm not going to discuss this part of the problem, which is too difficult, in my opinion. And just it's interesting to see how years after years people try to solve this problem, and new people come and still don't solve it. But hopefully with the improved simulations and more powerful computers, we'll understand how the jet is actually driven. So I'll focus more on accretion disk physics. Well, it's amazing thing that observation of the phenomena I'm talking about, JRBs, are completely different from X-ray binaries and quasars, of course. In quasars, for example, we would see UV bump from here. So you see the disk emission, you see corona. We discussed how many times photons are scattering in this corona, one or two times or three, forming this power law. Here, we don't see anything, any emission coming directly from this region, most likely, because, of course, if it explodes in a star, then it's completely opaque. Even if it's if we talk about merging neutron stars, we still expect neutrino-driven wind, which blocks you from direct observation of the center. So the emission you see comes much farther from the black hole on scales much, much larger than the Schwarzschild radius. So the energy is transferred from here to large scales, and then it's emitted. Otherwise, it's pretty much the same problem, especially at small radii. The jet, because the central engine, as David explained, has beginning and end, duration of this energy output is maybe a few seconds. You have the beginning of this jet and the end of this jet. And these beginning and end are causally disconnected from each other. They become they get in causal contact only at the radii, which are something like gamma squared, Lorentz factor of the jet, times c times duration of the burst, which will give you a number like 10 to the 16 centimeters. So before that, you talk about causally disconnected parts of the jet, and they behave precisely as you would deal with a steady state problem. At larger radii, you should switch your view of this problem and talk about impulsive explosion problem, and then talk about interaction of this ejected material with the ambient medium is a kind of explosion problem, which is different from normal jets. Now, again, probably the same jet mechanism as we discussed in X-ray binaries and quasars. So people who do simulations, MHD simulations, may be doing simulations of these jets and JRBs, because as long as you focus on MHD, it's about the same problem. What is different in this problem is, say, optical depth, radiation physics, infinite physics. But if you take this out of your problem, then it's this, then it will be just the same in JRBs and X-ray binaries, for example, especially if you talk about merging neutron stars. If you, of course, you have a star, then you should talk about how this jet drills for the star. But again, on small scales where you co-emitted energy, it's very similar. Now, MRI here operating in this disk is again, it's probably the same because it's highly conductive material and MRI should work in the same way. So people who do simulations of the disk, again, it's the same problem. Now to put this in the context of general accretion disk physics, the main parameter of the problem is M dot. And here just schematic, just reminder of what regimes of accretions were discussed. This is the standard radiatively efficient disk, Shakur-Sinayev disk, which works below Eddington limit. In imminent low accretion rate, we also discussed a lot advective gas pressure dominated accretion disk. And there is a range of parameters, a range of undot here where both solutions are possible. At super Eddington accretion rates, this 10 to the 18th refers to Eddington limit that you would get for a stellar mass black hole with efficiency of, say, 10%. So this accretion rate would give you Eddington luminosity. Above this, you have advective radiation-dominated accretion disk where radiation is trapped and advected into the black hole or away from the black hole just because diffusion time of radiation is too long. And then there is this desert huge range of M dot between 10 to the 18th to 10 to the 31, where you have this advective radiation dominated disk, which is also radiation pressure dominated. By the way, it's interesting to note that ratio of radiation pressure to the gas pressure actually decreases as you go to high M dot. It decreases as 1 divided by M dot to the 1/4. And then at high M dot, you finally hit this temperature. When you have this blackbody radiation trapped in the accretion flow, you hit the temperature for 1 MeV. At this point, the accretion flow changes crucially because the temperature is now high enough, or say a couple of MeV to be more precise, high enough for capture of electrons onto protons. And then you start to produce neutrinos at this point. And then these produced neutrinos can easily escape the flow, and then the accretion disk is cooled, and it's not advective anymore. Well, this is a summary of conditions in this neutrino-cooled disk. Because it has so high temperature, pairs have to be created there. And you maintain perfect Fermi-Dirac distribution of pairs. You maintain Planck radiation because it's optically thick, high temperatures, high densities. You can estimate densities. It's huge density, of course, because it's the same black hole, the same type of geometry, just accretion rate is huge, say 13, 14 orders of magnitude high, so density correspondingly is scaled to these higher values. And black body energy density is scaled to higher values. Fermi energy now becomes important. So this next qualitative difference from other disks, that Fermi energy, degeneracy of electrons, becomes important in the problem. And then, so you have this, the mild degeneracy, and you have neutrino cooling. These are two most important physical ingredients in this problem. These are two main channels of production of neutrinos. You have capture of electron onto proton and capture of positron onto neutron. And these reactions are fast enough to establish an equilibrium neutron to proton ratio. So the system is very simple. It achieves complete equilibrium in terms of thermodynamics, nuclear statistical equilibrium, and even beta equilibrium. These reactions are established kinetic equilibrium. So these disks are even simply to some, in some sense, because they are their material is described by complete equilibrium, and therefore you have just two parameters of this material, temperature and density, and then you can calculate pressure of everything, electrons, positrons, neutrinos, radiation, baryons. Just given these two parameters, you can calculate nuclear statistical equilibrium, nuclear composition of this, which is very important. This is just one plot which I wanted to show, just YE, the normal parameter, charge fraction of baryons on this plane, rho T plane. This is where YE is below 0.5. You have neutron-dominated region. Here you have composite nucleons. So and this line shows degeneracy boundary. Here you have strong degeneracy, here you have mild degeneracy. So you can get similar plot for pressure, for example, of a neutrino emissivity, and it will be calculated exactly, and it will apply exactly to GRB accretion disks. Now, the disk problem, of course, the previous plot doesn't answer what the parameters of the disk are, because it just tells you microphysics, and you want to know what is rho et in the disk, and so you need to construct a disk model. And the most interesting ingredient in this model is that is this feedback, which I described here briefly. If you have cooling by neutrinos, so you reduce the temperature, then you increase the degeneracy of this material. If you reduce temperature, then the disk becomes even denser, so density goes up, temperature goes down, you have huge degeneracy. And therefore, you have low positron density, because the ratio of positron density to electron density is exponential of minus chemical potential divided by kT. So you have fewer positrons, and therefore the two reactions of capture of leptons onto baryons, which are in equilibrium, have very low rate. And therefore, you reduce the cooling rate of the disk, and therefore temperature goes back to higher values. So there is this feedback which controls the disk, and as a result, it regulates the disk toward mildly relativistic state, where chemical potential is just between 1 and 2 times kT. So to the first approximation, GRB disk is where chemical potential of electrons is equal to 1.5 kT. Well, another part of the problem, of course, is neutrino transport, because at high accretion rates, like 0.1 solar mass per second, you have innermost region which is opaque to neutrinos, and this is the region which is cooled by neutrinos. Outside this region, temperature is below 1 MeV, so you just have advective accretion. Okay, so this is the disk model, which was done by Wenxin Chen at Columbia, a graduate student. This model has parameters of 1 solar mass per second, viscosity parameter 0.1, and this is spin parameter of the black hole. And this is how the model was constructed. It's vertically averaged. Neutrino transport is treated in the simplest way, just escape probability. It's one zone approximation, but it has full microphysics. Neutrino emission, as I said, only weakened fractions require really careful investigation, because you need to discuss this beta equilibrium. Then you have this model also have advection of lepton number and heat included. So you solve the equation since the material moves to the black hole. Hence, full relativistic, it's solved in pure geometry. So this is the result for this particular model. You see the temperature, so it's about outer region where you go to advective regime. The temperature is below 2 MeV, and the temperature rises toward the black hole, density rises. You see H over R, which is well below 0.5. H is half thickness of the disk. So the disk is very well cooled by neutrinos, and it becomes even thinner as it approaches the black hole. And this is YE. An interesting thing with this YE, of course, is first of all, it's below 0.5, so it's neutron rich, and for all reasonable parameters, you get YE always below 0.5, so the disk is neutron rich. You see this change in behavior of YE. This is where the disk becomes opaque to neutrinos, and here you have interesting neutrino transport, where, as you know, neutrino cross-section scales with temperature, energy of neutrinos as energy squared. And therefore, when you increase the temperature, the in contrast to normal disk, which becomes less opaque, the photons, the disk here with high temperature becomes more opaque because you increase cross-section. And therefore, the result, you trap heat better there, and the temperature goes faster than it would be otherwise, and therefore, becomes a little less degenerate, and YE is very sensitive to the degree of degeneracy, and YE goes up. Well, this, of course, one important issue is how this all connects to observations. And even if you have this model done, even if you treat it as a black box, jet formation, assume somehow you create relativistic outflow with Wren's factor of 100, let's say, you have this setup, still you would like to know eventually how you would see any signatures of this microphysics that I discussed, or this disk physics in the observed explosion. So this is the brief history and of the impact of neutron, which is, I think, the most interesting and probably the only possible way to see this, to connect this physics to the global picture of the explosion. So initially, you have expansion of the jet as a single fluid because it has very high density and just cools down adiabatically, temperature becomes very low. Then at some point, when neutrons decouple from protons, you have reheating of the jet. For the simple reason, neutrons and protons have to collide to maintain their common speed, and then you can think of it as a friction between these two fluids, neutron and proton fluid. So when they decouple and velocity increases, this friction becomes even stronger, and this friction heats the two fluids. So you have this reheating. Later, when neutrons begin to decay, they turn into proton with some relative Lorentz factor with respect to the ejector, to the jet, and therefore you get an extra heating. So temperature, neutrons, the first effect of neutrons on this jet is that they rise temperature by many orders of magnitude compared to the model where you have no neutrons. So the interesting physics, and in particular the calculation of Ye below 0.5, is that it gives you neutrons in the jets. And then, as a result, jets are reheated. Even later, when you go to this impulsive regime and talk about blast wave and afterglow production, you have another interesting effect where neutrons are completely decoupled from the ejector and decay, most of them decay at the radius about 10 to the 16 centimeters, which is comparable to the afterglow radius. This later phase depends on the precise Lorentz factor of neutrons, and the Lorentz factor may be high a few hundred, or it may be low, especially in the MHD scenario, if you have very slow acceleration of the ejector. So this is just to emphasize the difference between jets from quasars, for example, and jets from TRBs. The first order approximation picture is a collision rather than steady jet. You have just at this later stage, when you have impulsive explosion, you have a collision between ejector and some ambient material. And therefore, you have a sharp peak of energy release. Of course, it's time-dependent problem. So interesting thing about this problem is that you need very little mass to dissipate, say, half of the energy of this ejector, which becomes obvious if you go to the rest frame of this big ball, the ejector, and then you see the collision dissipates half of the energy if the ratio between this big M and little m is about gamma. So you need very, very little material to dissipate energy. Of course, in reality, you don't have these balls. You have some shell ejected. You think of it as a shell because it's thin compared to radius and in front of the shock. So if you take into account that this ejector decelerates gradually and it has some neutron component, then with time, whatever neutrons survived, they will overtake the blast wave and will decay ahead of it and do a lot to this ambient medium because the total energy in this neutron component, which is half of the ejector energy, is gamma squared times larger than the press mass. So when it decays, they have a huge impact until radii, which is about 10 times mean decay radius, which is 10 to the 17 centimeters. And the effect on the observed light curve was calculated recently in a couple of papers for the two scenarios I mentioned, the fast neutron and the slow and wide neutron component. And this is my summary. Just a few main points about GRB's disk. They're neutrino cooled when m dot is more than 100th of m solar mass per second. The neutrino opaque in the inner region when m dot is higher than 0.1. Equilibrium Ye is always achieved. For all GRB parameters, you can say that you have equilibrium Ye, and this Ye is below 0.5, which means that it's neutron rich. Now we have the self-consistent relativistic model for the disk, for Ye cooling rate in hydro. This is something I may want to leave for discussion. There is a question mark here, actually, whether this viscous disk model is appropriate for GRBs. And neutron-loaded jet here, I just wanted to emphasize again that the main observational impact of this accretion disk physics, neutron-rich physics, is the ejection of ultra-relativistic neutrons in the explosion, and then their later decay. Thank you.
Okay, questions? So what's the connection between producing a supernova explosion and a gamma ray burst? Are you referring to different processes or different regimes? Could you just...
Well, the simplest answer would be that if you focus on the GRB scenario, which involves massive star collapse, then you would say to create a GRB, of course, you need angular momentum in the star, which may not necessarily be the case for supernova. You may need angular momentum too, even in a supernova context. But so when you talk about this physics of neutrino emission, you talk about viscously heated material, which has relatively high temperature. In standard supernova models, and have just spherical symmetric implosion, have different entropy. And you don't go to these conditions when you have high temperature, this combination of high temperature density. Yeah, as long as you create...
It starts to be a leading process.
Yeah, you need angular momentum that creates a disk. And if you... So that was one thing which I wanted to mention here at this point. When the rates of GRBs are compared with the rates of supernova, the rate is like two orders of magnitude smaller. And the explanation is one of the simplest explanation, which, for example, Sten Woosley proposes all the time, is that you need some angular momentum to create a GRB, and in most supernova you don't have it. So when you think about GRBs as a tail of supernovas, supernova explosion at high angular momenta, so most of the supernovas don't have enough angular momentum to produce the disk, but some of them do have it, then there will be just few events, say 100 of these things that have angular momentum enough, and then this disk that you form around this black hole will be very small. Almost all GRBs will have very small disks just because you go to this tail. Well,
I have a comment to your first part. First of all, it seems to me that such a high accretion rate is related to very heavy disk, and in nature there could not be exist such a heavy disk which become stationary under such a high mass accretion rate. And second, if such a heavy disk exists in nature, then they should be very highly super Eddington. And if you see the outer layers where optical depth is close to unity, the matter will flow out with such a high speed that actually this could not reach the black hole and could be disrupted before.
I'm not sure I understood the second half, but the first part of the question is whether the GRB disks are dangerously too massive. So if you talk about, so that they will become gravitationally unstable, for collapsar disks, where you have core collapsing in time scale of 10 to 30 seconds, it's not a worry, because the mass that resides in the disk at a given moment in time is much smaller than, say, 10, 30 times smaller than the mass of the black hole. Right. So just the mass that passes through the disk. If you make a snapshot of the disk, and look how much mass instantaneously resides in this disk, this mass will be small compared to the black hole. This mass becomes large when you have some accretion rate, something like 10 solar mass per second, or definitely larger than 1 solar mass per second. Then you go to this.
The equilibrium is because of the You mentioned early on that for the merging neutron star model, you still would not see the accretion disk because of neutrino outflow. Could you explain how that would work?
Oh, this is simply, if you have this energy output that we're talking about in the case of GRBs, 10 to the 52 ergs per second, 10 to the 53, and most of this output is a neutrino, so it's very hard to avoid neutrino heating of, let's say, upper layers of the disk and just drive an outflow just by depositing heat. So you expect some outflow which, even if a tiny fraction of mass of the disk leaves the disk, it will be completely optically thick. Because the thickness of the disk itself is, I don't remember, it's many orders made, maybe 10 to the 15th or so. It's enormous.
Just a quick question. Davide Lozzati also mentioned that you could have perhaps a fallback disk onto a neutron star. I wonder if you've considered neutron star boundary conditions and the associated accretion luminosity and how that might change the flow. That was one question I had. The other question was, is there any region of parameter space where you're unable to find a steady state solution?
Well, first question. Fallback disk.
Like if you had a fallback disk onto a neutron star,
yes,
and it hadn't yet formed a black hole, then you might have different boundary conditions at your inner radius than you do with the black hole case.
What do you call fallback disk? Is it the disk that forms much later when
explosion? For example.
With very low luminosity and, I mean, with very long time scales.
Yeah, or perhaps you have this tenth of a solar mass per second for just a second or two onto a normal neutron star.
Well, it's a different problem. I mean, yeah, if you have...
I'm just wondering if you considered it. If you
no.
Okay. The other question was just is there any region of parameter space where you're unable to find a steady state?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I was hoping before we started to investigate this problem that we will find some runaway process, because there is a reason for that. As I mentioned, there is this feedback of trapping of neutrinos, rising the temperature and decreasing the cross-section, which might lead to kind of overheating of the disk. But so far we haven't gone to this high M dot regime where it could happen, I think. So far M dot is still below a few solar masses per second. And it would be interesting to see what happens at high accretion rates. But then also this gravitational stability may become important, so it's a difficult problem. And there are a few other interesting things like neutrino oscillations, and it's a very rich problem at high M dot. Okay, thanks.
Let's thank Andre again. And we resume tomorrow at 9 a.m.